Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Pennsylvania Ballet Artistic Director Roy Kaiser. The company's latest production is Marius Petipa's Giselle. Jason Pfeiffer talks with playwrights featured in the upcoming Philadelphia New Play Festival. We speak with two teenagers who are helping parents navigate local cultural events. And as Temple Theatre presents The Importance of Being Earnest, Susan Lewis looks at why, more than a century on, we're still laughing at the wit and wisdom of Oscar Wilde. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
The other great romantic ballet begins a run in Philadelphia this weekend. It's widely accepted that Swan Lake and The Sleeping Beauty are the giants of romantic ballet repertoire, but Marius Petipa's Giselle is right up there, and one of the reasons it's less performed is because of the stature of leading ladies required to execute the lead. For the new Pennsylvania Ballet production, Roy Kaiser has cast three of his principal dancers, Julie Diana, Riolama Lorenzo, and Arantxa Ochoa, in the lead. I spoke with Roy Kaiser earlier this week. What are the pressures on young prima ballerinas dancing this role that has become so famous over the last 100 plus years and has become almost a signature piece for great dancers like Margot Fonteyn, Galina Ulanova, these great dancers in the history of ballet?
Well, the role of Giselle has become a benchmark role. It has become a role that we not only compare ballerinas of today, but they are compared to generations before and generations before that. You just mentioned some of the most famous. So there's a pressure to that. There certainly is a pressure to that. I mean, I encourage a certain amount of individuality. Steps need to be there. There are steps that are expected and steps that need to be there. There is certainly a pretty specific musicality that has endured over all of these years. But the most successful ballerinas in this role, in my opinion, bring something of themselves to the role and find a way to make their performances specific to them.
That said, there is a balance between the fact that the role is that of a very young girl, but there's no way that you could put a 22-year-old or a 23-year-old into the role because it needs that level of emotional maturity. You can't put somebody in their mid-30s in it because of the athletic demands. Are you now in a situation where you fortuitously have three principal dancers who are in that kind of pocket, maturity-wise and athletically-wise?
Absolutely. It's a great place to be in when I program a ballet like this. I think you just said that ballerinas in their mid-30s are old ladies. Is that what you just said?
I think that's
what you said, Jim.
I think in their mid-late.
No, but you're right. In theory, you're right. There's a window of time, I think, where ballerinas... And this is speaking very generally, of course, because there are always exceptions to the rule. But there is a small window of time where ballerinas have the technical ability to perform a role like this and portray a young woman and have the experience artistically and the life experience and the confidence, I think, to portray the dramatic elements of the character.
This is perhaps one of the three great ballets of the 19th century. Why is it less well known than Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty?
I think, I don't know if there's a definitive answer.
Is it to do with the music, do you think?
I think it may have something to do with the music. I think that the music is a little less accessible than the other two ballets that you mentioned. And I don't know if there are, or if anybody's ever researched it or not. I would venture a guess, though, that Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty have been performed much more than Giselle. Some of that may be simply some of what we've been talking about, having the proper artists to perform the role at any given time. Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty both, while they certainly have their demands, their specific demands, I don't think they're as difficult to cast as Giselle.
Pennsylvania Ballet Artistic Director Roy Kaiser. The company's production of Marius Petipa's Giselle runs through February 10th at the Merriam Theater in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The first Philadelphia New Play Festival begins this week. 9 theater companies in the region will be presenting new shows concurrently, along with dozens of other theater events. While the 10-day festival features works by playwrights from around the country, there's a notable concentration of plays by local writers. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer has more.
One reality of the theater world is that new works can be a hard sell to those who produce plays and to audiences. It's not hard to see why. New work is unproven and often expensive to develop. Deborah Golden, executive director of the Theater Alliance of Greater Philadelphia, says because of the inherent risk in producing new shows, many theaters stick with the tried and true.
I mean, people keep coming back over and over and over again to see The Sound of Music, which is wonderful. But when you're putting up something brand new, it's harder to convince people to pay the money to go see it.
Golden says one of the things that makes the upcoming Philadelphia New Play Festival special is that so many major local theaters have committed their resources to make the event happen, presenting a vast array of artistic styles.
Each of our theater companies in Philadelphia does have its own personality, and that's being preserved in this festival. But we're coming together as a community, showing not only the unique personality of each theater that's participating, but this commitment that we have to creating new plays.
It's fair to say Philadelphia is gaining a reputation as a city that produces a great deal of new plays. It's not yet, however, on a par with Chicago, which has a long-standing reputation for new and innovative work, or New York, the U.S. theater capital. But people like director James Christie do see Philadelphia as a major player in the creation and production of new plays.
What seems to have happened in the last 10 years is that almost every theater commits itself to one or even two new plays a year. And so the place is really rich with that. You have a big, I would say a quarter of the theater, a third of the theater is new work, which is amazing, supported by other stuff that's recent successes or classics or musicals or stuff like that. So I think it's a very vibrant scene in that way.
To consistently produce new work, there is, of course, the need to have a good base of working playwrights. And in the Philadelphia region, there is a core of such writers. One of them is Bruce Graham, whose play Dex and Julie Sitting in a Tree and the one-act Full Figured Loves to Dance are both part of the New Play Festival. A nationally produced playwright and screenwriter, Graham credits Philadelphia as having a deep and positive influence on his work, perhaps because it's not a traditional epicenter for theater.
I think where you're raised definitely has an input on your point of view. I'm very blue-collar. I'm sitting here in my Eagle shirt right now, and a blue-collar, literally. But I think that's a kind of value system because, I mean, my friends, my closest friends, really aren't in the theater. My closest friend works for SEPTA. And I think it's important that you have a life besides the theater. Now, some people, especially in L.A. with the movie business, I mean, that's all. Everybody there, your gardener has a screenplay under the weed whacker or something. And that's all they talk about. And it's like, I guess, living in a coal town back in the 1870s or something. It's one industry and that's all they can talk about. And then you find yourself only able to write about the movies.
Graham admits that his last play, according to Goldman, was indeed about the movies, but he says he's gotten that out of his system now. And there's indeed a lot of other subject matter for writers in Philadelphia, according to local playwright Thomas Gibbons. Gibbons, whose newest play, A House with No Walls, just opened at the Interact Theater, says Philadelphia also has had a direct influence on his work over the past 15 years. Three of his plays were inspired by Philadelphia occurrences: the MOVE bombing, the Barnes Foundation debate, and the controversy surrounding the building of the Liberty Bell Pavilion on the site of George Washington's slave quarters.
It's a city in which the past and the present coexist in all kinds of really interesting and surprising ways. Particularly, say, if you go down to Old City, I mean, everywhere you turn, you're confronted by history. And it, to me, it's very fertile because I'm fascinated by history. I always have been, and I find myself inspired in a lot of my plays by either recent history or more distant history. So from that point of view, it's a fascinating city.
Besides offering the benefits of rich history, Gibbons says Philadelphia is also a good home for writers because of potential funding resources in the region.
Playwrights are supported pretty well here by the Pew Foundation and the Independence Foundation giving fellowships.
While it helps to have an occasional grant, few playwrights are able to make a living just from writing for theater. Being in a relatively smaller theater town undoubtedly has its drawbacks. Growing an audience base and getting national exposure can be difficult. But Philadelphia-based playwright Arden Cass, who has two one-acts premiering in the New Play Festival, Soul Searching and Kick Me, says there are some benefits to being in a lesser-known theater hub. For example, in her view, Philadelphia doesn't have the same cutthroat atmosphere of New York.
It's a small theater community. A lot of us know each other. We know each other's work. And I think it's a very supportive community in that way. People are recognized if they do good work, and they're given opportunities eventually to put that work on stage and share it with people.
With events like the Philadelphia New Play Festival, which organizers hope to offer every 2 years, it looks like local playwrights will only get more opportunities to share their new works.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer, who this week was named a 2007 Individual Creative Artists Fellowship recipient for Arts Commentary, Perspectives on the Arts, from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. Congratulations, Jason, from all of your colleagues here at WRTI. And the Philadelphia New Play Festival opens this Thursday and runs through February 18th. The Walnut Street Theatre is in the middle of an 8-week run of Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. During dress rehearsals for the production, there were two writers in the theatre to preview the play. And being a run-through, the show started late, so the writers had plenty of time to catch up.
Maybe I'll just give your mom my design, because like, I like to see
Katie Gillians and Juliette Picone are not your typical theatre reviewers. But even at 16 years old, the two look as comfortable in a theatre as they might at the mall. For the past year, Katie and Juliette have been doing art, music and theatre reviews for Curious Parents magazine, a regional publication that Juliette's dad happens to own. And why not? If her parents owned a restaurant, chances are she'd be washing dishes or waiting tables part-time. Juliette explains how they began their journalistic careers.
It was about a year ago, and my dad wanted me to do something with my time. And since I like writing and I really like seeing plays and shows, we came to a compromise about reviewing plays. And Katie has been my best friend for 11 years now. So my dad said I needed a friend, so I picked Katie.
At 16 years old, an 11-year friendship is a very long one indeed. The girls became friends in kindergarten. Now that they go to separate high schools, this is the one time each month they know they'll get a chance to see each other. Juliette explains their process.
If it's based on a book, we read the book, we'll research the artist or the producer, and we'll find a lot of information about the show. And then once we go to the show, we will take notes during the whole show about like the actors, the acting, the visual effects, the staging. And then while we're at dinner, we'll talk about it. And then most of the time we write it actually together. Mm-hmm. And we'll come up with a first draft, and then we'll type it up, and then we'll edit it together. And if we can't get together, then we will email it back and forth to each other until we like it.
Next, the article goes to parents to look over. After it gets mom or dad's approval, it's sent to the magazine's editor for a final critique. And speaking of critiques, the girls make it very clear they're reviewers and not critics.
Every show, they have to work very hard, and we are promoting the art, so we find the positive, and every show has something positive.
The whole point of this is to promote families to go see different arts and to promote more of a cultural experience and cultural outings. We don't want to hurt any performance. We want to really promote people to go see it.
Their column is called Dinner and a Show. Therefore, the girls also include an overview of a restaurant near the venue. They feel the dinner component of the evening is not just a bonus, but also an important aspect of their mission, says Katie.
It gives you an opportunity to talk about the show with everyone else that saw it. So it really gives you an extra chance to sit down and really be with the family. And that's what a lot of the readers want. They want a time for their family.
And by family, they mean parents and younger siblings as well. Katie says the inclusion of younger kids is important.
We want the younger perspective. Most of the shows we're seeing are geared towards a younger age group than we are. But we're also trying to get the feel of an entire family going to see. We ask our parents or whatever parent is there with us at the show. We know our own opinions as teenagers. And then we use the opinions of the younger kids to see if families would really like it, which age groups it's really geared towards, and if we should really recommend an entire family to go see it, or if just older kids to see it.
For Of Mice and Men, this was an important point. John Steinbeck's 1937 novella is a tragic story of two lonely migrant workers. The classic but heart-wrenching tale is not exactly a story for a very young audience, which the girls will mention in their column. 12-year-old Patrice Marrow, who went along to the Walnut Street Theatre with Katie and Juliet, agrees that her age should probably be the cutoff point for this show.
I thought it was a very good storyline, and it was unique, I guess, that I would say that. And it's probably, like she said, good to an older audience.
This is not usually the case, as the girls try to pick shows for the whole family. In Juliet's experience, most homes have more than one television. Therefore, the family gets fragmented throughout the house, according to interest and age.
There's just such a variety of age groups on the TV. I mean, there's the prime time and then cartoons for the kids. And it's hard to get one show that everyone likes and a play or a show. It just has, I think it's more of a family thing than watching TV, because TV, it's just too wide of a spread.
Therefore, they see cultural outings as an opportunity for shared time, which Juliet's mom, Jackie Picone, says has been good for her entire family.
Well, we have 6 children. It does force us once a month to do something cultural. I think they've done a wide variety of things between the shows and the exhibits. And Wilmington, we've been to a dinner theater and a tiny little puppet show in New Jersey. So I think it gives them a very broad experience of culture.
Both Katie and Juliet enjoy writing the reviews, and although they don't see it as a job, their least favorite part of writing the column is probably the same as the least favorite part for many professional writers, as Juliet's mom reminds them.
The deadline.
Oh, right. Because sometimes we'll have to see a show the day before a deadline, and we have to write it, see the show, get together, edit it, and then have it all done before deadline.
And during field hockey season or during the middle of a play,
that's
we're lucky
hard.
If we find time. Yeah. So it's sitting okay. There emailing it back and forth and up all night trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And we're not together, so it's not as easy. Yeah. So it's one of the tougher parts.
But they do get it done. Juliet and Katie's review of Mice and Men can be found in the February issue of Curious Parents magazine. If what is good art can be subjective, dependent on individual tastes and sensibilities, humor in art can be even more so. What makes you laugh may or may not make your friends laugh. A joke that convulses an 8-year-old may leave his mother or grandmother scratching her head. And what's funny to Americans may or may not be funny to people on the other side of the world. Yet while some humor is dependent on culture or politics or gender, other humor transcends time and space, like that of Oscar Wilde. This week, Temple Theatre stages Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. The 19th-century Irish writer and raconteur once observed that the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about at all. So now, WRTI Susan Lewis talks about Wilde.
Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wilde did not come from a particularly funny background. Born in 1854, he grew up in a prominent family in Dublin, his father an eye doctor, his mother a poet and journalist. He studied classics at Trinity College Dublin and then went on to Oxford. Mike Barsanti, associate director of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, has studied Wilde and says that it was at Oxford that Wilde began to blossom. In a Victorian age where art was expected to convey a moral or message, Wilde embraced aestheticism, a movement that promoted art for art's sake.
I think Wilde's embodiment of this aesthetic movement was part of a broader movement that was a kind of reaction against a late Victorian sensibility that was morally righteous, but also focused on industry and money. For him, art was about life and about cultivating yourself as an artist.
Before he wrote a single play, Oscar Wilde had become famous for being, well, wild. Irreverent and expressive, he wrote art reviews, but his flamboyant persona made him a celebrity and even inspired a character in the Gilbert and Sullivan opera, Patience. Wilde toured the United States to promote the opera.
He would do things like wear, velvet suits with knee breeches, and his character in Patience is always carrying around a sunflower. He would wear, large flowers in his lapel. He wore his hair long. Just his style of dress was incredibly extravagant. People were so amazed by Wilde, he was just odd.
And being a bit of an oddball is one of the more classic sources of humor, says actor and comedian Tony Braithwaite.
We laugh at the unexpected. We laugh at others' misfortunes. Comedy is a person in trouble. We laugh out of relief. from stress. And we laugh at that which is on everybody's minds but no one has spoken about yet.
Wilde's signature move, says Mike Barsanti, is to take a cliché and replace one word with its opposite.
I can resist anything but temptation. It's the word temptation that makes that work, right? By only changing a few words or a few, he can turn a whole set of ideas on their head. It's a really wonderful bit of kind of like jujitsu, where he's able to just take, to use the language and manners of this rigid upper class world, and through just a few replacements or just a few twists of things, is able to show the kinds of hypocrisy on which it all rests.
In the mid-1880s, Wilde settled down, a bit. He married, had two sons, and worked as an editor of a woman's magazine. He also published a book of fairy tales, sparked by the stories he told his children, and wrote essays. In the next decade, however, his life went into overdrive, professionally and personally. In 1891, he published what would be his only novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Although he couldn't get it produced in England because of its biblical characters, his 1892 play Salome would later inspire Richard Strauss's one-act opera of the same name. By the end of 1895, Wilde would have four successive hits on the English stage: Lady Windermere's Fan, A Woman of No Importance, An Ideal Husband, and The Importance of Being Earnest. Earnest is a play about two 19th-century couples who find romance and love, but not without some twists and turns.
Next week, Mr. Ernest Worthing and I are engaged to be married.
My darling Cecily, there must be some slight error. Mr. Ernest Worthing is engaged to me. The announcement will appear in the Morning Post on Saturday at the latest.
I'm afraid you are under some misconception. Ernest proposed to me exactly 10 minutes ago.
It is certainly very curious, for he asked me to be his wife yesterday afternoon at 5:30. If you would care to verify the incident, pray do so. I never travel without my diary. One should always have something sensational to read on the train. I am so...
Nicole Urban as Cecily and Melissa Mann as Gwendolyn in rehearsals for Temple Theatre's production of Ernest. More than 100 years later, the words of Oscar Wilde can still make us laugh out loud in screen adaptations of his plays, in his imminently quotable quips, or in productions like Temple's.
He basically makes fun of everybody. And somebody once said, and I think it's true, that all of the characters are really just variations on Oscar Wilde himself.
Dan Kern is director of Temple Theatre's production of The Importance of Being Earnest. He says that this play has no deep social message.
It's based on a Gilbert and Sullivan play. Actually, I think it's just Gilbert's play, Engaged, which is a sort of silly little farce. But he took it and he simplified it, streamlined it, basically used it as a vehicle for some of the catchiest, funniest lines in modern English writing.
I really don't see anything romantic in proposing. Why, it is very romantic to be in love, but there is nothing romantic about a definite proposal. Why, one may be accepted. One usually is, I believe, and then the excitement is all over. The very essence of romance is uncertainty. If ever I get married, I'll certainly try to forget the fact.
Ryan Jones playing Algernon. The Importance of Being Earnest was a huge hit on the stage, but offstage, Wilde's life was collapsing into its own melodrama. Mike Barsanti says the paradoxes which may have inspired his humor also characterized his life.
One of the sources of Wilde's humor is that Wilde was someone who always was between two worlds, whether it was his sort of mixed identity as being an Irishman in the heart of London, a kind of strange class consciousness where he was really a kind of middle-class guy in an upper-class world, or most importantly, perhaps, his being a man with a very complex sexual life in a Victorian age that didn't accept that.
His sexual orientation was now frequently the subject of speculation. His marriage had fallen apart, and his close relationship with Alfred Boysie Douglas so enraged Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensberry, that he publicly accused Wilde of being a sodomite. Wilde filed a libel suit, but lost. He then was put on trial for being a homosexual and was sentenced and served 2 years in London's Wandsworth Prison and in Reading Jail. He never bounced back from this fall from grace and died of cerebral meningitis, penniless, in Paris, aged 46. His art, fortunately, lives on, perhaps longer than he ever would have imagined. The Importance of Being Earnest is an example of comedy that transcends the generations.
It's the way the words are put together. It's the sound of the words, but it's also the musicality of the words. The way the words are said in that social setting is just funny.
But even men of the noblest possible moral character are extremely susceptible to the influences of the physical charms of others. Modern, no less than ancient history, provides us with many most painful examples of what I refer to. If it were not so, indeed, history would be quite unreadable.
I beg your pardon, Gwendolyn. But
the characters are in universal situations, finding identities, falling in love, courting. There's humor in the language and in the situations, and I think that's what makes it sing still today in 2007.
It seems that great humor, like any art form, lasts. Like Mozart, Michelangelo, or Matisse, it can dip into the past or make sense of the present. Great comedy has an instant and universal appeal that connects artist with audience and audience members with one another. It touches hearts, minds, and most importantly, funny bones. Oscar Wilde said, "Some cause happiness wherever they go. Others, whenever they go." Wilde's been gone for more than a century, but his words still bring smiles wherever they're heard.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Temple Theatre's production of The Importance of Being Earnest previews on Wednesday. It opens Thursday and runs through February 17th at the Randall Theatre on Temple's main campus. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Theresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Debbie Fleischman, Megan Wendell, Karen Gross, David Galston, Sean Stone and Patricia Allen. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.